Tonight is nothing short of spectacular. I think you can all feel the excitement of an exhibition we've all been anticipating, and the excitement of this opportunity to hear directly from the artist and curator of that exhibition. Big Camera, Little Camera, a major survey of work of Lori Simmons, opens to the public this coming Sunday and is here through January 27th before it goes on to the MCA Chicago. The exhibition does a beautiful job of mapping Lori's career, laying out her various series for consideration while honoring individual works, and peeking into the installation, I can tell you it looks absolutely fabulous in this building. Important to note that this is not without thoughtful consideration and hard work on the part of all involved. Andrea Carnes, the modern senior curator, knows these galleries well, and she has always had a collaborative spirit, working well with artists. Laurie and Andrea have been forming this exhibition for, I think, about 3 years, and have spent long days this past week seeing it come to fruition. Laurie Simmons is an important American artist who has been brave enough to share herself and her keen observations in work that ranges from photography to collage to film, with a narrative quality that makes it feel familiar but doesn't close anything down. Drawing emotion, making us feel, seems to be her objective. I won't track her illustrious career now because the exhibition does a great job of that, and I'm sure we will hear about the journey a bit in tonight's conversation. I would fill you in on her most recent involvement, but good luck. Laurie Simmons is absolutely everywhere right now. I think something shows up in my inbox almost every day, another group exhibition, presentation, interview, so on and so on, that involves Laurie Simmons. Last spring, she had two solo shows open simultaneously in New York, just to make my point. The Mess and Something New at Salon 94, and The Clothes Make the Man at Mary Boone. So suffice to say, she is in this 100%. And we are the beneficiaries. Tonight's conversation is a generous act upon the part of both Andrea and Laurie, who absolutely have to be exhausted at this point, but are here nevertheless to give us insight into their process, Laurie's career, and a preview of the exhibition we are all anticipating. So please join me in welcoming Laurie Simmons and Andrea Carnes.
Thank you, Terry. And first, I just want to start by saying a very special thank you to Jimmy Choo and Harper's Bazaar for your leading support for this exhibition. We are so grateful for our friendship with you, and I know that you've worked very closely with my colleagues here to make this exhibition possible. We have representatives from Jimmy Choo and Harper's Bazaar here with us tonight, and Laurie is modeling some Jimmy Choo shoes this evening. And I also want to thank the Warhol Foundation, the Klein Hines Family Endowment for the Arts and Education, Baldwin Gallery, and Salon 94 for their exhibition. For your support for this exhibition. We are so grateful, and we think that you will all see what it means to the exhibition. So I think tonight what we want to do, we know that you guys have not gotten to see the exhibition yet, so what we want to do is give you an introduction. Many of the works in this exhibition have not been seen before, or at least not much. Some things not at all. So we want to tell you a little bit about it, and then you'll see the exhibition over the next few days. I shamelessly put a picture of the catalog up for you all to see first. So we're starting with this work, and Laurie, I want you to say something about this. This work that Laurie showed me on one of the many studio visits we did together over the last three and a half years.
I just want to start by saying that so many friends flew in, and every time I find one in the audience, I get overexcited. So if I, and I'm so happy that so many people who are so important to me are here. But this group of pictures called Cherry Wallpaper is something that I assumed would never see the light of day. It's the way I did not study photography in art school, and it's the way that I learned to use a camera, and it was a very private exercise. I moved to Soho when I was about 22 years old and got a gigantic loft on Broadway between Prince and Spring for $150 a month. I know that makes everyone hate me, but it really was... It really was in the dark ages when that happened and was possible. And I built a tiny little space and papered it with vintage wallpaper. And every Friday night I used to wander around Macy's. That was my Friday night activity, and it was actually a good place to think about ideas and to buy clothes on the $10 rack, rejected designer clothes, and that was sort of my habit. And one night when I was wandering around, I found sheets that matched the vintage wallpaper. So I created this tableau. I hate looking at this because I really don't think I washed my sheets very often. they're grimy, forgive me. I was 23. But it became a tableau where everyone that was in my life, everyone that was important to me, everyone who just came through casually, passed through my room, and I would pick up my camera and make a portrait of them. So a group of them are in the show, and I think that the most surprising thing for me about the show is that I don't consider myself a portrait photographer. It's not even an area I feel comfortable in, and yet Big Camera, Little Camera begins and ends with a group of portraits.
So. Here's a self-portrait. I just changed images.
Yeah.
I think what made me so interested in this and wanting to show it in the exhibition was that it, Laurie here is experimenting with the camera in 1976 in a serious way, for the first time really, but also creating these environments that later became these stage scenes and dollhouses. And for anyone who knows her work, it's such an amazing foretelling or, you know, presage to what was to come shortly after and then continue for a very long time. And I think in this image in particular, there's a kind of distortion between the sheets and the wallpaper. And, you know, you were like searching for that kind of thing, a shift in scale or something that a camera could do that could trick us or make us not quite, you know, something that could be jarring in an image. I'm just sort of flipping through these.
Yeah, so this is someone I went to art school with. There's just a
no, this is
oh,
what they're saying.
Oh, right? That's me.
You did go to art school with you also.
These things are very confusing.
This one. Yeah.
This is someone I went to art school with. And this is my friend Jane Kaplowitz Rosenblum, who was with her boyfriend Robert Rosenblum at the time. And they, the late and great Robert Rosenblum, and Jane, my first best friend in New York, is actually here. I think her plane made it. She's in the audience somewhere. Did Jane make it? Oh, I know everybody ended up in Austin and Houston and Little Rock. Everybody that tried to come because the weather was so bad, but
so many, I will say, so many people have come for Laurie, and she said she was inviting all these people, and everyone always does, and then maybe three people come. This time it's like full house. We love it.
Yeah, another friend, a Dutch friend, and another friend from art school, someone named Steve Keister. And so some of you, a lot of you know these people, and
so I want to move on to this image, which is Big Camera, Little Camera, the namesake for the exhibition, and ask you to talk a little bit about it. But, I mean, we thought, along with a lot of people who support Laurie, that this would be a good name for the exhibition because it's an actual camera next to a prop of a camera. And so, you know, it says so much about what she has done, and
Well, it's a very it's a tender photograph for me because my father, like a lot of fathers in the 1960s, was an amateur photographer, a terrible amateur photographer, but also one of my greatest inspirations in terms of how he would take pictures, like the flat-footedness with which he composed things. And he loved to, he would always get a new camera, and he loved to give me his old cameras, which I've yet to figure out how to use. I was using a Yashica GT35 automatic camera, and he used to hold his camera and say, the bigger the number, the less the light. And he would get really confused. He would have this mantra about how f-stops work. And his cameras were... It's sad that he never got to use a fully automatic camera, that he lost interest in it, because he struggled. So I always saw this as a kind of tender portrait of my father and me. Something also that I kept private and didn't bring out for people to see until I think the late 80s or even early 90s.
So this photograph I know you consider to be like photo number one, ground zero.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that you, in this image, we see a miniature sink and then actual IV wallpaper, and then there's water, real water, in the sink. So it's these three elements that are of all different scales, and some from real life, some more fictional. Why did this feel so gratifying to you?
I think because, you know, I was so influenced by conceptual art and process art and fashion photography and all kinds of photographs that were documenting the current, you know, the 1970s art process. And I had a job shooting, I had a very short-lived job shooting toys for the Shackman Company that was on Lower Fifth Avenue. They made miniatures. And I quickly lost the job because I basically at this point had no photo skills whatsoever. I tried, but what I did do was take some of the toys I borrowed to shoot and just place them in front of vintage pieces of wallpaper that I'd collected and fill them up with water. And somehow I saw something here that appealed to me, that seemed like it was more than just a dollhouse tableau.
So we don't have the title of this work up, but it's from the series, the early black and white series. But the title is Sink IV Wallpaper. So most of your titles are like that, non-poetic, descriptive of what is actually...
Well, I think that's very poetic,
actually. Well, okay, arguably
no,
poetic.
They're descriptive. I think they're descriptive, you know, and...
Descriptive.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, your titles tend to be that way.
Yeah.
So to me, that just, it speaks to the conceptual exercises that you were going through, mm-hmm. somewhat. I don't know, maybe you think of it differently, but...
No, I think...
Yeah.
I agree.
So then I know in the beginning, even though here you have a miniature sink, you were hesitant to use dolls. But then you did.
I did... And this is another picture that was, a gift for my friend Jane. I think that she's probably the only person in the world who has this print, and I've never shown it until this show. But I was embarrassed to use the dolls because I felt like the interiors without dolls were tougher and could kind of pass for a tougher kind of more conceptual, more thoughtful art. So the doll pictures were super private, and I shot for a long time without inviting the dolls into the picture, and then once I did, I was extremely private about it.
Do you think that, in addition to not thinking of these as tough, you felt like you were giving out some kind of information that you weren't sure you wanted out by, I mean, like about scale or...
I didn't want to break scale in any way because I was under the illusion that some of the early interiors could be confused for real places, which seems very naive right now. But, you know, it's interesting to think about the idea of photography in the 1970s was photography was, photographs were considered something that would be about truth-telling, not about lying. So I figured that I could make these rooms that would be very spatially ambiguous and also have be of a kind of ambiguous scale. And also the dolls were just flat out embarrassing because they were like girls' play, like girls playing with dolls. And that was the last kind of image that I wanted to project either of myself or in my art.
Well, I mean, I think they get pretty tough. This one, for example, with the chalk line. I know part of what you were doing was bringing in this abstract element with the chalk, but
well, I kept thinking if I moved a doll into a room and then took it out and then made a chalk line where it was and then moved a rug in and a rug out and kind of followed the movements of the dolls around the studio, that I'd be making work like Barry LaVey or Mel Bachner, you know. I mean, it's almost it's silly to think that those guys influenced me, but they really did. And the whole idea of marking time and the passing of time and mm-hmm. movement about spaces, that's what I was looking at. So I was struggling for ways to bring that into my work.
But the chalk line does bring in this other element, like a police chalk line.
Yeah, it does, and I don't remember thinking about that at the time. Yeah.
Here's another example. So here you're using the doll, the miniature sofa, and then you've drawn the rug. And you'll see in the exhibition this sort of exercise that Laurie goes through where then she puts the rug in front of the sofa and, you know, kind of moving things in and out, almost like you're animating something or making us as viewers notice what the differences are, or
trying to make you follow my process. And the interesting thing is, when I try to install these photos, I can never follow the logic. We had so much trouble installing it because it's wait, the rug's in, the rug's out. Wait, so I was trying to play with ideas of logic, and there ultimately is no logic.
Speaking of trouble installing, that made me think of something. I just want to say that in this exhibition, Laurie has been working for 4 decades, creating 36 photographic series over the 4 decades. And that ends up being approximately 700 works. So the exhibition, what we've been doing over the last over 3 years is trying to figure out what could be represented, what could represent Laurie best that could be in the exhibition. So we have, I don't even want to tell you how many things because it sounds intimidating, but we have approximately 118 works in the exhibition. But some of those are very small works, some of those are large works, and that part of the process wasn't easy because no matter what was happening in Laurie's personal life or career, she continued to make work. So I just think that's so impressive. I mean, over having children, over everything that's ever happened, or along with, not over, you were making art.
That's true.
Yeah. So it was hard to figure out what to put in the show. So the kitchen works.
Well, the secret about this kitchen work that's been in books and I've shown it over and over is that there's a toy radio in it. I don't think I've ever told this story before, but now seems like a good time. I used to listen to the radio while I worked, and there was a radio contest, like send the most interesting picture you can dream up of a radio, and if we like it, we'll send you $100. And I really needed the money. So I made a group of photographs, about 5 different photographs with the toy radio in them that felt very much like this. And of course I didn't win the contest, but I keep thinking about some radio station, you know, I don't know what it was, WNEW or whatever we used to listen to, that somewhere in a dusty corner are 4 of these photos that I would love to have back. signed and everything. Well,
it's too bad you didn't win. You could have almost paid your rent for the month.
I could have. Yeah.
But, I mean, the works are showing the sort of the flip side of what it means to be a housewife in America. You know, you were showing the dark side of domesticity. I don't know if you thought of it that way. That's how I think of it. But
I thought of it like a memory, like recreating a memory, because in my own memory of my own suburban upbringing, even at that time, even in my 20s, there was a kind of fluidity between what I saw on TV, what happened in my house, what I read in magazines, because there was a very narrow band of options of what it was appropriate to be. So everyone was really trying to look and act and be like everyone else, which is sort of made that a very extraordinary moment in history, particularly visually. So I think about these things not as out now critiques of domesticity, nor do I think of them as fond and beautiful views of domesticity. I just think of them as a kind of recording of my own memory of it through my filtering system.
And you have a good quote that I quoted in the catalog about thinking about your upbringing and your mother and, you know, coming of age in the 1950s and how that time was both beautiful and lethal. Mm-hmm. And I think about that a lot when I see works like this. Here's another example from the same series. And I know that it's important to you to say, and you just said it, that you're not critiquing, but rather you're just making observations about sort of prescribed gender ideals in America, but also showing this other flip side. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that nothing is ever as perfect as it looks, and I think that we all know that. And, you know, making that kind of perfection, that kind of visual perfection, a goal, it's there's innate failure in that, because nothing can ever live up to that. And that's something that I think I figured out at a very young age, which made me very uncomfortable and made the rest of my family very uncomfortable. You know, it was like the little demon seed who could see things. But you know, as I do meet a lot of people who say that they had the same experience as a child, that they knew that something felt like it wasn't right in their...
Even if it looked right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In this image and in the one before, some of the props are out of scale. The milk in this case. And then, well, and this is in both the Heinz can. Mm-hmm. And I know that in addition to what you were doing with, you know, you're looking at gender, looking at idealism, you were also playing with scale and light and shadow and color in this case, because you did the same kind of series first in black and white. Mm-hmm. What made you, I mean, did you feel like it was brave to move it to color, or just a next logical step? Or?
It was just a goal to move to color, like to have, you know, to kind of raise the bar. And since I didn't study photography, I'd have to keep learning the next thing, and it seemed like color photography was the next thing to learn.
And how did you, I mean, are you saying you just learned by experimenting, or how?
I learned, well, the very tiny prints in the show were printed by me, and when I wanted to learn color, I bought something called the Cibachrome, which was a new material, the Cibachrome Discovery Kit, and it was a little kind of tube this long and, you know, like this diameter, and you would expose your picture, like in a dark room, put it inside the tube, and pour these chemicals, which were beyond poisonous. This stuff's not even on the market anymore. But you would pour the Cibachrome chemicals into one end of the tube, and I would watch TV and roll it for 5 minutes while it developed, and then open the other end and pour the chemicals out, probably into my sink, you know, near where I was cooking. And this was like a three-step procedure. And the Cibachrome Discovery Kit came with a box of 4-inch by 5-inch paper. And that's why all of my early pictures are, you know, these little pieces of paper that came from the kit. So that's how I taught myself how to print color.
So this Cibachrome is a positive print, a slide.
It's you shoot slides and it's positive to positive, whereas most other ways of printing are usually, you know, black and white negative to positive or color negative to positive, which is the way, for instance, I think William Eggleston prints. And interestingly, around 1976, William Eggleston had a show of color photographs at MoMA, the Modern in New York. And people made such a big deal about the fact that there was finally a color photography show at MoMA. And, you know, for someone who'd been reading magazines or had a father who was an amateur photographer or was just in the world, it seemed so crazy to me that they were making such a huge deal mm-hmm. about this show, you know, which I went to see.
I think, you know, the thing that there's something about the color in these early Cibachromes. It's just over the course of your career, how you make these works has changed so much. I mean, like you said yourself, you can't even get these supplies anymore. Mm-hmm. And so you've gone from a complete analog situation to now a digital situation. And I know that you've flowed with that. I mean, you're fine with that. You're moving with the times. But do you feel like you can get the same kind of color and atmosphere now? Or
I do, and the reason I shoot digitally is very simple, because my printer, Gabe Greenberg, who's also here, told me that he could make better prints if I shot digitally. Mm-hmm. And that was a big sacrifice for me, because I love the objecthood of slides or negatives. I like organizing them in books. I like knowing that I have them. And the most difficult thing about working digitally is that the storage options. And, you know, we could all get really nerdy and geeky about this, but the storage options change for storing digital media, so that I have some images that I saved on a floppy disk. And probably most people in the audience don't even know what a floppy disk is, or let alone how to read it. So this is kind of serious. I think it's a serious problem, but once I understood that I could get the kind of quality and color and feeling that I get in the most very recent pictures in the show that my printer gave to print, that convinced me that I had to work digitally.
And both examples are in the exhibition, of course. We're still in the early work here. But we wanted to show you guys this slide. It's a bathroom scene in one image, and then the other image is a work by Gordon Mata Clark. And we put this in really kind of to remind ourselves who you were looking at, what you were thinking about. And so I want you to say a little bit about Mata Clark and the splitting and the houses and how he documented his work and how you related to that, but then also about the actual bathroom scene. So.
Well, I loved his work, and his main project, he had a number of projects, and his main project was to take abandoned houses and cut them in half. He had a crew of people. It's hard for me to explain how they were done. I saw a lot of them, but then he would document them with photographs, and I love the quality of the photograph. And, you know, in a sense, he made it seem like his houses were small, because it seemed like so easy to sort of slice them in half and separate them. But I loved his work. I loved his activism. But I really loved the photographs that were the remains of what he did, that were the documentation of what he did. And I was really influenced by them.
And so, he's doing that with actual abandoned, derelict homes, and you're doing it with dollhouses. Mm-hmm. So there's a difference, yet, you know, I know that you were, because you've told me, that you were, you know, always thinking about the not only the formal side, but the conceptual side, and how to, I don't know, justify may not be the right word, but how to think about what you were doing. And I know that, you know, you're showing us here, we can see through the bottom of your dollhouse, that it's put together, the seams don't meet, you know, you're letting us see that. But you're also showing us a space that, I mean, there's no doll in this space, but do you think of that as a feminine space? Are you focused on that at this point?
No, I think I was thinking more about control and, you know, the idea that I could bifurcate the rooms, that I could make a half living room and a half bathroom mm-hmm. wasn't really real, but it sort of looked real. And there was something of a feeling I got about when things were out of whack, when walls tipped, and when the scale was inaccurate, that it gave me a kind of feeling when I was shooting, like it wasn't really dizzy and it wasn't really unsettled, but it was some pleasing feeling that made me want to, it made me go after disparities of scale, because it made me feel good. I know that's a kind of an odd thing to say, but.
Well, here's another example of that. So these shoes, mm-hmm. they're Jimmy Choo's.
Yes. Very old ones.
The first pair ever. But the shoes are so large in the corner of the room.
Right.
And the shoes are props.
The shoes are props. The shoes are actually, and there will, if no one else in the room remembers this, my sister is here and she will remember it, but it, this was a Cinderella slipper and it came with a Cinderella watch in it. And I never got one. I always wanted one. My sister got one. and I found them. These aren't the ones I had, but I found them as an adult. And just the way they were like white alabaster. They're plastic. They're really cheesy. But I just thought the shape was so beautiful, the quality of the plastic. And they reminded me so much of, you know, Sleeping Beauty, Cinderella, you know, just all of that, all of those fairy tales.
And this is another work from that mm-hmm. same series, showing some of the miniature furniture.
Mm-hmm. And lit from, you know, like starting to really get the idea to light from the bottom and really make that plastic glow. And I think the end result of that, like what I was starting there is, you know, 20 feet long in the mess mm-hmm. at the top of the stairs, the most recent photo, my most recent photo.
Also, I should say, we included some of these props in the exhibition, and they have never been seen before or displayed before. But Lori has meticulously kept them color-coded in Tupperware.
Mm-hmm. In Tupperware.
So, or, you know, plastic bins over the years. And so we decided to include not everything, but just a group of those works in the exhibition. And it adds this sculptural element, but it also tells you something about what she was doing and the things she was actually experimenting with. So these are a series in which you use your husband Carol Dunham's toys from when that he used to play with when he was a child with his mm-hmm. brother, and they are male dolls.
We're so at the beginning, we'll never get through our slide lecture, but
we're going to start hurrying.
Since I know
a lot,
I know everyone will see the show. I hope everyone will see the show, so you'll see the work we don't get to. But I think that one of the push-pull things that I was experiencing when I was when I was a young artist, I kept thinking that pictures of girls were going to exclude boys. Pictures of women meant that men wouldn't look at my work, and I kept kind of scratching my head and thinking, well, how can I include the male viewer? Viewer being a new word that, you know, that I learned when I came to New York. And the equivalent of these, you know, sitcoms I used to watch on television when I was a kid, like Father Knows Best and The Donna Reed Show and all of the sort of perfect 1950s, early 60s, these perfect domestic mm-hmm. bliss shows, what was the equivalent of that? What was the male equivalent? And I felt like TV was also populated mostly by cowboys, that was, as you said, that was what virility was, that was what maleness was. And there was a lineup of Saturday night TV shows that we wouldn't miss for anything. They were like Gunsmoke, Have Gun Will Travel, what was the other one?
Bonanza.
Yes, right, Bonanza, that's right, yeah. So these were, anyone who remembers, these were really important. These guys and characters were really important to us. So I felt like if I did this cowboy series that that somehow I could include men in my work. So, periodically I try to figure out a way to have a male subject. I think the next time after this were some swimmers underwater, And then again after that were ventriloquist dummies. So I just keep trying to, where can I go with images of men? How can I find them?
And the cowboy was a place to start, like the macho, idealized cowboy.
Right.
I also want to say here that the date is 1979 on these. And Richard Prince did work with cowboys, and David Leventhal did work with small figurines. These artists came of age when Lori did in the 1980s. But I just want to say she did it in 1979, which was before them. And she probably would not say that, but I would. But also in these images, there's another exercise going on here, which is, actually this one maybe shows it better. We have one image with the cowboys in the grass. These are called Brothers Hay, with the horizon line, and the other one with no horizon line. And obviously these are small, tiny little horses and cowboys, and the blades of grass look giant. But I mean, you know, again, always something going on with scale and perspective and working with the camera, the aerial view.
Well, I think it was also the took very long time to satisfy my desire to make film. But there was something about moving around the inanimate objects or the still figures that made me feel like I was animating it or doing something, you know, filmic, playing with the idea of film.
I think the next series illustrates that as well, and we're going to start hurrying because we are going to stop talking at 10 till 8 and let you guys ask some questions. But the next series is called Pushing Lipstick. It's in the exhibition. This is my sort of undeniable, unabashed favorite series in the exhibition. But what I love about it is, in this case, Lori's using the dolls with an actual tube of lipstick as a dance partner. So I think it was the first time that you used a real object.
I broke scale. I wasn't happy about it. I think that all of us artists, we make rules. We're really strict about our rules, and then we break our rules, and we feel bad about it, and then we make new rules. But that's what happens when you're your own boss for a really long time. And I was sort of upset about these pictures, and I kept them very private. I kept them hidden for a really long time because I loved the connection of the purple lipstick and the purple dress and the red lipstick and the red dress, but I just wasn't comfortable with that kind of reveal.
I think, you know, observing, not critiquing gender roles, but in this case, there's this sort of phallic dance partner that's a tube of lipstick, an actual tube of lipstick, and these little dolls, and the lipstick is cumbersome on these crude stages. But again, like, you're setting up what you would later do, which is make a film. And
right.
These really, I think...
And I wanted to say that we actually made a lipstick for... I collaborated with someone named Poppy King, who used to have the line of lipstick called Lipstick Queen. And we made a color that we're going to sell at the gift store that's called Pushing It. So I'm really... I haven't seen it. It's arriving tomorrow, but I'm really excited about it.
So this is a series called Family Collision that you made with dolls in water before you ever had children.
Mm-hmm.
What were you... These are a different size doll also. What sort of prompted this?
Well, I had in the show a number of photographs that we didn't include here called Water Ballet that were real people swimming underwater. And it's always complicated to talk about them because I'm loyal to them, but in a very profound way, they don't fit anywhere quite... It's not a good fit with the rest of my work, but I've always kept them close to me. So when I was done with that, and when I was done with shooting real people underwater, and when I got very tired of working with real models, I made this series where I just took... I knew they were going to be black and white, and I just dropped dolls. I had an underwater camera and just dropped dolls in the water and shot them as they were falling. And The underwater photos of real people are so alive and turquoise and seem to be about living and One is called Splash, and they came on the heels of the death of a very close friend. And I think being underwater was a place to be that was soothing. I just liked being there, so that was an excuse to make the photos. When I made these, they were much simpler to make, and they felt like they were actually very much more about death and stillness. And they're one of my favorite series, and something that's relatively, I don't think many people have seen them. I don't think I've had taken many opportunities to show them.
Yes, there are a few series here that haven't been seen a lot, so we felt that it was important to include this for a number of reasons.
Yeah, and I think that I love the abstraction. I loved feeling like I was just noodling around at the edge of abstraction.
We have five more minutes, so we're moving along. But I do want to talk about this. This is from a series called Strip-Ins, and this work, there are three of these in the exhibition, again, not seen.
Right. I think the one thing I would want to say about this is that this was way pre-digital, obviously. It's like 1981 or 82, and I had this desire to put figures in rooms where they didn't belong. And I had a friend who interned at an ad agency, and she said after hours that she would do this very elaborate thing and cut the figure out and make it look like it was standing in the room. This is my sister Susan in a pink towel. And I wanted her to be in a room that we never had, the kind of room we didn't have when we were younger. It's very different. And, you know, the thing that amazes me about this group of pictures is that if I'd had the internet, if I'd had digital technology, if I had Photoshop, I just could have done these, you know, forever.
These are pre-Photoshop, and it wasn't easy to do.
Yeah.
But you were longing to do that kind of thing. So these are from a series that you'll see in the exhibition, this called Color Coordinated Interiors. This is Green Kitchen. Some of these figurines are in the exhibition just so you can get a sense of scale, and they're like this big, which in my mind they were at least the size of a Barbie doll. But what's interesting about this is the rear screen projection.
Yeah, rear screen, when I realized that it wasn't feasible to really work with someone at an advertising agency, I couldn't afford it, it took a long time. I understood that if I projected slides in the background and put figures in front, it could almost look like I was placing a figure in its own environment. And in those days, you could go to the New York Public Library and look through these very ratty files and find a file that said green room, and then check out pictures of interiors. So all of the backgrounds, and you could also borrow slides at the Met. So the tourism pictures that are also upstairs have backgrounds that are world monuments, and all of this stuff was easy to get, easy to find, but you'd have to go to a library and check it out and set up a rear screen projection. So again, that was a slide my father bought in front of the, when he would travel, he would buy the existing tourist slides, again, because he was such a terrible photographer, and mix them in. He would mix them in with the family slideshow. And we knew which pictures were his and which he had bought. But the really great news for me is that I took them all. You know, I took all of the ones that weren't his tourist slides, and was able to recycle them. The next one is also one of his slides.
These are this one?
In fake fashion.
Oh.
It's a background slide.
Wow, I didn't know that. Okay, so this is another series titled Fake Fashion. And, again, going back to the exercises you were doing, you started with dolls. Actually, you started with people, with the cherry wallpaper. Mm-hmm. Then no people, no dolls, then dolls. Now here you're making these fake fashion scenes, again with rear screen projection or backgrounds, and actual people. Were you wanting these people to look like dolls?
Yes, for sure. And this was the first time I felt like I found a place where I could get a human to look more doll-like. And of course, later on, and I'm sorry we can't get through everything, but in the Kigurumi series, where I actually have people in cosplay masks who really are you know, there really are cultures of people now who see themselves as part doll and part human. And I don't know if I'd found all of this stuff. I mean, it's like I'd been searching for all of this imagery my entire life and then, you know, waiting for it. And then, you know, now it's here.
Well, also the notion of fake fashion, like fake fashion ads where people are so idealized anyway that, you know, they're not right. Like we really
well,
are.
Well, I also really wanted to shoot fashion and wasn't getting any jobs. And I thought, I'm going to make my own fashion shoot.
With thrift shop.
With clothes that cost, you know, sort of almost plastic clothes you could get on Broadway at that time that cost like $3 for a blouse and $4.
So we're really speeding through now. But these are, these works are in the exhibition, Walking and Lying Objects. Do you want to talk about where this leads? And
I think that probably people who do know my work probably know this work the best. But my favorite thing about the exhibition is that I made a movie in 2006 called The Music of Regret, which is a movie where I said goodbye to 76, 86, like 30 years of work. And these characters, the walking objects, come alive and they dance. They're played by the Alvin Ailey dancers. So there's a moment in the show when you can turn to one gallery and look at all the walking objects and turn the other way and see the film, The Music of Regrets. So you can see them dancing and singing and then look the other way and see the still pictures. And it's a really favorite moment of mine.
So going from then using oversized prop, from tiny props to oversized
right.
props, to actually, and that series led to eventually The Music of Regret, the photographs, and then the film, which is in the exhibition.
Which is it's a 45-minute musical, but we have it in a little theater with chairs and on a loop. So, and I think it's three acts, and each act is discrete. So I think you can sit down at any point in the film and probably understand or enjoy at least some.
It is very nice to look at the photographs of the walking and lying objects and then see them animated in the film, which we didn't, I mean, it wasn't really planned that way, but it sort of beautifully worked out that way. So we are out of time. Should we skip to your new work for now?
Sure.
Okay, because I think, I'm sorry to miss all of these, but so the Love Doll going to using real life-size rooms mm-hmm. with these Japanese love dolls. So changing from dollhouses and tiny dolls to larger dolls in real environments. Going back to the kitchen like the early work. I think we'll...
And then another...
This
is the cosplay anime kind of outfit that a lot of Japanese kids can put on their Kigurumi mask and assume a personality and move around the world with that personality and
like a doll.
They're like living dolls.
Here's a selfie of a dollar.
Yeah, it's a 2014 selfie that one of my dollars took of herself.
So we'll just say a little bit about How We See and then the new...
How We See is a series that was also influenced by Japanese culture. And, you know, in my sort of my deep dive into internet culture, I would find things when I and also the people in my studio were looking for subject matter. We were finding things like... teenagers who painted anime eyes over their eyelids, and there was just so much that came from Japanese and anime culture that we found interesting. And I love the idea. First of all, I love that it wasn't my idea. The idea of painting an eye over a lid is not. I don't claim that idea. And in fact, people are always coming up with images to share with me of like a Dada image or. Something that they find where an eye has been painted on a forehead or over lids or on the back of a hand. But I love the idea of painting on the closed eyes of fashion models because for me they're like unicorns. It's very they just look so beautiful from any angle, and it was such a relief to try and do portraits with them, because it was easy for me to find a way that they looked beautiful. And I moved from that into a second series. Well, that's the mess. That's at the,
well, we'll go back to
yeah,
that.
Anyway, this is the next iteration of this series where I painted articles of clothing or jewelry onto my models, and the models became more, they became people that some knew, refers to people that were very either new friends or new gender. There were two models in the series that were in the process of transitioning gender, and my new dog who's upstairs in the galleries.
Your children.
My children. And three of the models, Hayden and Cyrus Grace and Andriana, are here too. So if you see familiar looking people wandering around.
They are here. It's nice to have the people. And here's Penny. I wish she could be here.
But. Yeah.
Oh, it didn't come up? That's the newest child in the family.
That's really an eye roller. Everyone, oh.
So we need to wrap up here, but we can either talk about my art or we can go back to the mess for a minute.
Both. I think my art is simply it's my first feature film. It's going to be playing at the museum.
It'll be playing actually in here in the auditorium.
Yeah, and I. It's a story. It's a real story. I think that's something. It's a story about a 65-year-old woman artist who's looking to kind of regenerate and find her voice in her work. It's a coming-of-age movie. It is. and then The Mess is kind of the end of the romance with plastic. Because, I'm sure everyone has seen The Graduate, and one of the first lines in the movie is, "I have one thing to tell you, son, Ben, plastics." And plastic at that time, at least starting in the 1940s and 50s, moving into the 60s, was the substance of the future, the thing that we could all rely on to take us into the next century. And the most interesting thing about it is that it's become, primarily that which is going to destroy our planet. And yet, for me, it still has this kind of beauty. Although it's a lethal beauty, lining it up, lighting it, coloring it, finding all these objects. I consider it my first picture, the first picture of many that I hope to make about global warming and climate change. And of course, there was just some more really dire news this past weekend. But the thing is also that it has a kind of beauty that can't be denied. The substance is toxic and beautiful, which really brings me right back to my very first photos. So it's probably a good place to end.
Yeah, I think that's good. Thank you. We would like to take some questions, if any of you have any, for a few minutes. Yes, Judy.
Did you play with dolls as a child?
No. No, I think probably now I would be diagnosed with ADD or ADHD, but I really envied girls that could sit and really play and dress and undress, and there were many of us, cut the hair off, rip the head off, that. So I didn't have any kind of special relationship to dolls.
Yes. What was your first exhibition, either in a gallery or a museum, and what was the critical reception of the work?
My first exhibition was at Artist Space in New York, 1979, and it was the Tiny Dollhouse Pictures. And when I went to see the director of Artist Space, I wasn't going to bring the dollhouse pictures. I was only going to bring these very dark, serious little pictures of chairs and tables. And my boyfriend at the time, who is now my husband, told me that I had to bring the doll pictures. And I was really frightened, but he said, you can't leave without the doll pictures. And I brought them, and the curator or the director of Artispace really was only interested in the doll pictures. I exhibited them, and they were written about in the Village Voice by Ben Lifson. It was called Robert Frank and the Track of Life. And the Track of Life part was about my work, and it called me a feminist photographer, which really shocked me. I was floored. I mean, I considered myself a feminist in real life, but I didn't see myself as a feminist artist. So that sort of started, that's kind of where everything started.
Yes, I was wondering about the early tiny doll that you had in the kitchen. Her arms and legs are all wrapped up with something, you know, almost kind of like a mummy. What is the reason?
That was the way they made the doll so they could be bendable. It is like an ace bandage material. And I know it looks odd. I got so used to it because I shot them so much, but it was just the way they made, you know, bendable.
I was trying to go bendable, back to that, but I can't do it.
No. Carolyn.
Did she make the dress in the first photo? It was the flower dress in the very first photo you showed with the wrapped arms and legs.
That she did.
It looked like a handmade dress. It wasn't a
You mean me dress. Or the doll?
I thought maybe somebody in the studio sewed a little dress for the plastic.
No, I never made. I had a real rule about never making anything. I did, because I thought this is something you know, the generation before us, the feminist artists before us used hair and menstrual blood and weaving and all kinds of activities that were considered, you know, female-driven activities. And I thought, I'm not making anything, I'm not knitting anything. I'm only going to find things. And if I find them, I can use them. And that was one of the rules that I...
Yeah. Finally,
No. In fact, I have two dolls like that have the same dress. Yeah.
Yes. Jenny.
So, I was interested about the title of the article that you just referred to about Robert Frank and light, because...
The Track of Life. Yeah.
Question was about light, because lighting in your images seems to be a really important element of the photographs, and yet for me the lighting is not flattering. So I wondered if you could talk about the quality of light in your images.
Well, light, I still think of it like my liquid gold. It's the most important thing to me in my work. And the first place that I lived, the place that I mentioned on Broadway, it was a very long, like, shotgun loft with a few windows, like three small windows in the front. And I would wait for the light to come through. I would wait for times of day when the light would hit my little setups, and it wasn't very long. So the beams of light that came through were really precious to me. I mean, I had to wait for them. And I think because I shot in natural light, I got used to a kind of high contrast. And high contrast, I know this from when I filter on Instagram or whatever, that I'm really drawn to the more lurid colors and to very, very, very high contrast. But I think it's a taste that I acquired. I mean, I understand that you would call it unflattering light, but I think it's a taste that I acquired at the very beginning of being a photographer. Yeah, I would agree with that.
Hi. Yeah, so I'm really interested in your relationship to media, and I know that in a lot of these early images you were thinking about magazines, having worked for a magazine, and then having spoken to a lot of young photographers, they're looking at the mess and looking at those photographs and thinking about the ways that you're engaging with this kind of proliferation of image. And even thinking about before that, when you're dealing with that collage in an analog sense. And so I just want you to talk about your relationship to media throughout all of these works, because I think that that's an undercurrent that hasn't been discussed.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, much has been said about the pictures generation, a name that I dislike terribly.
Yeah.
And, you know, the name for my generation happened in 2010, and we were all taking pictures in the late 70s. So But the point is, we're often considered the first. We are the first generation that was raised, raised on and by a television set. And one of the things that I was very self-conscious about when I got to art school is that there was no hierarchy in terms of art in my own household. Like my mother, my parents knew I was an artist, and they took me to see the Mona Lisa, and I remember it really well. But they would save, a beautiful drawing on a shopping bag from a department store, from Lord & Taylor's, and tell me it was beautiful, or buy a Don Quixote painting, or take me to a museum. And they didn't understand high art, low art, no art. So everything that I got, all of my inspiration, came from Life magazine, Look magazine, picture books, comic books. And my father was a dentist, and his office was in the house, so I could go in any time and just have this stack of magazines and a fish tank, of course. But I felt like I had so much art available to me. So I sort of like stuff from the media seemed like it was my nourishment, really. And it wasn't until I went to art school or even moved to New York that I started to really grasp what art history was and how different art history was from the image bank that, that I was exposed to.
Do you feel like that made you able to embrace the idea of the selfie and other things earlier than, say, you see in mainstream photography that's running parallel at the same time?
Well, I think because my particular generation wanted to work outside of the, again, the history of photography. When I started taking pictures in the 1970s, the history of photography, which seemed like a lot for me to learn at the time, was 130 years old. That's so young compared to painting or sculpture. So I think that even though photography was so young, there was a kind of snobbery around it, and it was being controlled very much by the Museum of Modern Art, particularly John Sarkowski. So the idea that you could take a camera and call yourself an artist and deal with a camera and the images irreverently was kind of a new idea. Although, of course, we had Andy Warhol and Baldessari and other artists that even, all of the conceptual artists I mentioned who were using a camera in different ways. But it was a little bit about sort of thumbing your nose at this very recent history and looking to embrace, looking for a way to embrace those other kinds of images. Because it all happened at once. I mean, that's the most interesting thing I think about it.
I think this is where we need to stop for tonight. We appreciate you all being here so much. We hope you will come and see the exhibition and spend a lot of time with it. Thank you, Lori.
Thank you.